Hi everyone, I'm Greg from Pilot Institute. We train drone pilots all over the country.
Hi, my name is Haya from Drone Excel, where we cover all the drone news on our website.
Welcome to the latest episode of the Pixel Drone Show, our weekly podcast where we talk to industry professionals about what they do in the UAS space.
From professionals who use drone to fly inspection missions to public safety users or even drone light shows, you will learn on the Pixel Drone Show that drones are much more than just toys. All right. Well, everybody, welcome to the next Pixel Drone Show. We've missed a few episodes over the holiday season and now well into the new year. But today we have a very exciting guest, Blake Resnick, the founder of Brink Drones. And he's going to tell us all about a new drone that they launched last week by the time this show comes out. We're recording this Friday afternoon, almost weekend. But Blake, welcome to the show. And thank you for making time available this Friday to talk with us about the Lemur 2.
Yeah, no, truly my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Awesome, awesome. Where should we start? Do you want to back up and talk about the first generation Lemur and kind of how that led you into the second generation? Or where do you want to get started with this?
Yeah, no, that sounds good to me. Kind of the story is I was working on a couple of different projects. I grew up in Las Vegas. The October 1 shooting happened, not too far from my house, which was, it was like fairly traumatizing for just the entire community. And that is what initially got me thinking that maybe there was a place for, modern technology in the hands of first responders to equip them with additional tools to try to deal with these sorts of events. Which ultimately led to me, cold calling the SWAT team, Las Vegas Metro SWAT, having some initial conversations. That resulted in an early prototype of the Lemur drone. I then went on call with them for a while. So I would, get like the 3 a.m. call saying there is a barricade at this address in Vegas and we want the drone. You should come out and let us fly it. I would do that. That's, I would say, more than anywhere else where, where Lemur really got developed was me riding along on those missions and seeing where the technology did well and seeing where it did poorly, and then going back home and re-engineering it as I discovered sort of future problems. From there, Vegas Metro became our first customer. Grown a lot, sold to around 400 other public safety agencies all over the world subsequently. Did a lot of missions, primarily in tactical and SWAT and high risk, law enforcement style events, but also a lot of missions around collapsed buildings and hazmat response and just like a wide array of public safety missions. And through all of that, we just learned more about the product and what sort of the ideal version of Lemur would look like. And now with Lemur 2, we've wrapped in all of those learnings and also all of our development as an organization, into a new drone.
Wow. So did you have like the drone in mind already from day one, like going back to that mass shooting when you were with the police, where you're thinking, okay, it needs to work with a drone?
Yeah, that's a good question. I did walk into that first meeting thinking that a drone would have been a pretty good solution for a couple of reasons, but I wasn't actually sure. But kind of throughout the duration of the conversation, I learned like a core capability that SWAT and public safety in general needs on a regular basis is the ability to get eyes and ears in dangerous places. And it doesn't really matter like what is carrying the camera and the two-way audio system, the thermal imager, and whatever other sensors you equip. It's sort of not important. Like it could be a terrestrial robot, it could be, an underwater vehicle, it could be a blimp, it could be anything. It just so happens that, a quadcopter is a pretty good way to carry all of this equipment up, for example, 14 stories, blast through a window with a glass breakers. We build, the only drone in the world with a glass breaking function, fly inside and then, inspect a couple of rooms for someone that might be trapped, for example. It'd be very hard to do that with a different platform. So yes, I did think a drone might have been a good solution, but it was really through those conversations with first responders that I became convinced it was the right, you know, the right technology solution.
How did you land on the FPV model rather than a non-FPV drone? Was there an iteration ever initially that didn't have FPV and then you realized this is easier? What was the advantage in your head in doing that?
Yeah, by FPV, do you mean like the goggles?
Yeah, just having the goggles on rather than having just somebody looking at a screen.
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's definitely been some development here. The very first versions of Lemur were piloted through a pair of goggles. The reasons why we liked that were we thought it resulted in better pilot performance. We thought it resulted in higher levels of immersion. We thought that it would also be helpful at the time to help first responders kind of ignore what was going on outside of, you know, their immediate surroundings to be able to really focus on the piloting operation. And that is what incentivized us to originally go down the goggle path. The problem though is when we started showing this to new teams, you know, outside of Las Vegas Metro SWAT, their feedback was, we put these things on and yeah, it's great for piloting, but if something happens in these situations that we have to deal with, that we have to focus on, you know, we hear a sound or there's a gunshot or, you know, a fire changes in an unexpected way, it's actually really bad to not have that additional situational awareness around us. Yeah. To be able to just quickly look up and deal with whatever that situation is and then go back to a piloting operation. Mm-hmm. So with that, we made the transition from goggles back to a slightly more conventional, you know, screen integrated controller. So now with sort of the later versions of Lemur S and with the first versions of Lemur 2, we're not even really offering much of a goggle component. It's still compatible because our controller outputs HDMI and you can just wire that into whatever goggles you want to use. But predominantly our drones are now flown off the screen. So it's definitely been a development process and something we had to get some customer feedback around to really understand.
So in a few short years, you guys launched the original Lemur drone. You took all the learnings and this week you launched the Lemur 2. I'm looking at an image here of the front of the drone and there's a lot going on there. Can you kind of talk us through the different sensors that you guys have built into this drone? Because I don't really think there's any drone out there that comes anywhere near the capability of this drone in terms of sensors and equipment that's on board.
Yeah, it's a unique platform. Happy to do that. And yeah, a lot of the sensors of the drone are mounted up front just because that's kind of where they get the best view for our use case. So the first is, you know, Lemur was the first drone with a two-way audio system. We have kept that core functionality with Lemur 2. So underneath the drone is a high-powered speaker driver. And then in that sort of front sensor cluster is an extremely sensitive Electret condenser mic. So both of these things are hooked up to a 4G module that's inside the airframe of the device. And the drone literally has a cell phone number. So you can pick up your cell phone, dial it up, call, and then the drone is just sort of like an absurdly loud flying speakerphone. So that's the first thing. Very important though for, you know, hostage negotiation, crisis negotiation. We found also use cases in search and rescue where, you know, we might blast out a 14-story window, you know, fly inside, land the drone, call it up, then call out with the drone. You know, these are search and rescue officials. If you can hear this, you know, yell, and then we'll listen through the microphone to, you know, to hear if we can pick anything up. We did that kind of thing in Turkey just last week, actually.
Oh, we definitely need to come back to that because I know a few years ago in Japan, they had drones with microphones that were able to pick up sounds from people that might have been buried under the rubble from earthquakes and stuff. So we'll definitely come back to that. But there's more on the front, right? You have LiDAR. Keep going. There's a lot more going on. We're not done yet, I think.
Yeah, not at all. All right. So we got this two-way audio system. We have a full blown time of flight LiDAR system, as you described. So, as our drone is flying around, it's generating a 3D point cloud of its environment. It's then using that point cloud, number one, to send back to users. So we're sending back 3D models, but also importantly for our use case, 2D floor plans. This is unique because think about a SWAT team situation. You send in the drone first, you clear all the rooms. Now you're looking at a live, up-to-date floor plan of the structure you might have to send your operators into. That is extremely helpful from a planning perspective. It's also used for what we call obstacle awareness. So other manufacturers build obstacle avoidance systems, and we're always a huge fan of that because it prevents users from crashing. But a lot of the time, it also prevents users from actually nosing their way into areas that, you know, might be really confined, which for our use case is almost all of our missions, many of our missions. You know, we're flying through a window, we're flying through, you know, a hole in a wall, we're flying through rubble, like the ability to actually get in tight areas that might barely fit our drone. So what we've implemented is a system just to slow the drone down. So it'll never prevent you from clearing an area. It'll just lower your velocity if it expects that you're about to crash. So you'll just bump into something lightly while still enabling you to kind of fly exactly where you have to. So that's a cool function. Smart. And then this full time flight system is also being utilized for localization. So for teaching the drone where it is in the world. And it's one of the things that makes our, you know, position hold function really robust in GPS denied and zero light conditions. It's utilizing the LiDAR instead of GPS or more conventional VSLAM technologies in order to figure out where it is. So it just works really well in our operating environment. With that said, we still do use a camera for some localization tasks. So under the LiDAR is a tracking camera. That's using some AI and ML to pick out a bunch of tracking points. Then it's using more conventional computer vision to track those points frame to frame. And it's using all of that with our IMU. So that is also teaching the drone roughly how it's moving, where it is. And across from that, we have a really bright autonomy floodlight. Really bright, however, not very visible to the human eye because it's running more of like blue style wavelengths. So we're flooding a scene with light that humans can't really see very well, but our cameras can see very well. And it's making our cameras robust in zero light conditions, which is also really good. So
that's really cool.
Yeah, that's stuff on this kind of the sides of the drone. All of that is, we're still not to the gimbal. So the gimbal is kind of like centered in between these two nacelles almost on either side of the front of the aircraft. One cool thing about the gimbal is it has a full 180-degree range of motion. So it can look straight up. It can also look straight down and anywhere in between, which is very helpful because you think about, again, a collapsed building scenario or a situation where the suspect might be inside of an attic. Just really nice to be able to look straight up, kind of position the drone, and then just push the throttle stick up to ascend exactly, exactly where you expect you're kind of going to go. Then on the gimbal, we have a 4K camera, which is transmitting like actual legit digital HD video back to your handheld controller. That's a big upgrade over Lemur S, which is relying on analog. That is also our night vision camera. So across from that, we have a night vision illuminator. It works similarly, so it's very powerful, but not very visible to human eyes. Illuminates scenes very well, monochrome, so it's just black and white. But if you're okay with that, it's extremely useful. On top of that, we also have a very powerful white floodlight with a strobe function. So you're somewhere dark, you want full color, you don't care so much about being seen, you can turn that on. And then also in our gimbal package is a FLIR lepton. So, you know, you can see people under blankets or, wow, you know, people in collapsed building scenarios, all that kind of stuff.
Is there anything that's missing, like a fire hose maybe you could add still to it or something? I mean,
well, actually, I'm glad you brought that up because this is all expandable. So underneath of the drone, we have a Picatinny rail. That's where our glass breaker attaches and our dropper attaches. But it also has bidirectional data. So it's kind of like a glorified USB cable, USB port. So in the future, we're really excited about developing, you know, like a tri-gas sensor, for example, for hazmat operations. We're interested in Geiger counters and, you know, radiation detecting equipment, all that kind of stuff we'll be moving into.
You have the ability to expand. Yeah, that's smart. You mentioned the switch from analog to digital. What was the reasoning in the first place to have analog versus digital? Was there an easier access to parts? I know that I'm sure the pandemic hasn't been nice to you guys with that. Was it a country of origin? Because I think the drone is also NDA compliant, right? So is there was yep. there an issue there with that?
Yeah. You know, analog actually has a lot of advantages. A lot of advantages. It has very strong signal penetration characteristics. So, you know, a high powered analog signal can get through a lot of walls. It's extremely low latency in general. So, you know, the footage coming off the drone can be transmitted to a control monitor with, you know, 20, 30 milliseconds of latency, which is in fact even lower than that in some cases, which can be incredibly helpful. The parts are very small and very lightweight, so they can be integrated into the drone and the controller really nicely without adding a lot of weight or complexity. Cost is relatively low across all these components, so these are all very legitimate advantages and make it a pretty reasonable choice for a drone like, you know, like we built. The primary disadvantage, though, is the video looks bad. You know, it looks like 1970s video, and you get into like multipathing situations. There could be flashes of color on the screen, and you know, it can be a not super pleasant piloting experience. And with this, we wanted to solve it. But yep. I'll tell you what, I mean, the costs associated with implementing a digital video system and the extra engineering complexity that was involved was really extreme. I mean, I would say the costs of our digital transmission system are, I mean, they're like literally 10 times that of the analog.
Wow. So this was not just getting a DJI O3 Air unit and building it in.
Well, that's a thing, right? We build an NDA compliant drone. So yeah. Unfortunately, those aren't components that can be leveraged. But DJI has done very impressive stuff with their video transmission technology. It's just, you know, it's been like a decade long effort with unbelievable amounts of investment from their side.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then go ahead, Haya.
Okay. I was going to ask, like, with so many sensors and cameras built onto this drone, like, what kind of flight time and battery life do you get? Because I can imagine that this draws quite a bit of power, doesn't it?
Yeah, it definitely does. So I think what we're publicly advertising is 20 plus minutes. I am hopeful we can get it to 25 by the time we start deliveries, which is Q3 of this year. I think there's some easy wins that are achievable there, switching to some new battery cells, which recently came up on the market. But that's kind of the rough range we're talking about.
Yeah. That's cool. That's actually impressive for having that much equipment on it and being rather small. You had a technology on the website that you call a mesh network. Can you tell our viewers a little bit more about the advantages of what it does, how it works, and all of that?
Yeah. This is also contributing to the cost of, you know, of our transmission system. It is a magnificent capability, though. So sort of the way this works is drones, handheld controllers, and even body-worn radios act as mesh networking nodes with this new system. So you think about a situation where you have to clear a large commercial building, for example, a mall. It is extraordinarily difficult to get a point-to-point radio link to work through 20 concrete walls. Yeah. Nearly impossible. So, you know, we've experimented with a couple of different approaches to fix this, but really the best solution is just placing breadcrumbs along the way so that every time you have a point-to-point link, it's dealing with, you know, 5, 6, 7 walls instead of 20. And that's what this mesh networking capability is enabling. So you have this huge commercial building, you know, you send in one drone a third of the way into the building. You're then using that drone as a signal repeater, and you can send additional birds deeper in and then just breadcrumb them back as far as you want to go. Very useful in malls, you know, useful in government buildings, useful underground. It's really sort of a game-changing capability. And in
So what kind of range would you be able to get? Like, how far into that mall system can you fly if you build a network like that?
You can go through the whole thing, almost regardless of size.
As long as you have enough nodes, either what carried by a human or with another drone or however you would do it.
Our drones are flying nodes. So the way you'd probably do it is take off drone one, fly a third of the way into the building, land it there, perch it. From there, it'll have, you know, 6+ hours of battery life. Now you take off another drone from that same launch location and you can clear the whole thing.
I would say that's brilliant.
Most large, you don't have to drop anything. You can just use the birds as nodes in the system. And we sell a 2-pack. So you can get one case with, you know, 2 aircraft, 1 controller, and, you know, use it in this way as much as you want.
How does the setup work for the user when with the mesh network? Is there anything that they need to do, or is any drone that you produce, any Lemur 2, becomes a repeater for anybody's drone?
Yeah, so we basically, as of today, we configure it from our facility. So the same customers will get drones that are all compatible with one another. It's a good question, though. It'd be very exciting if in the future a bunch of neighboring agencies could all function on the same network. So in a large event, you know, their equipment would be cross compatible.
Yeah, security issues, I'm sure, would be
Yeah, I was going to say the other thing that is sort of exposed to the user is, you know, you can use one of our handheld remotes to control multiple drones. So it is selectable in a settings menu, you know, which of the drones that are powered on you actually want to see a live video feed from and control.
That's cool. I do have a question about the NDA compliance. Can you explain and maybe talk about Blue UAS, talk about the difference between NDA and Blue UAS, why the interest for you on the NDA compliance side? Are you also interested in the Blue compliance side as well?
Yeah, very much so. So we're very interested in Blue UAS compliance. We're very interested in Green UAS compliance as well, which is what we're actively applying for as a first step. So NDAA compliance means no electronics effectively from countries on like a known entity list. So China is you know one of the countries on that list, which is very problematic because the entire drone global supply chain is really based out of Shenzhen. Mm-hmm. So almost all of the off-the-shelf components that you know, a company like mine might want to utilize in a product like this, we basically can't use, which has forced us to develop an amazing amount of our own stuff. Many drone subsystems we could not find, you know, functional commercial options for. And that caused us to basically have to develop a lot of it with in-house capabilities. So yeah, that's what NDA compliance is. Green UAS and Blue UAS is that with additional cybersecurity checkpoints that have been completed, done by, you know, government, quasi-government agencies. So it's an additional seal of approval that, you know, there isn't anything in your aircraft that might pose a supply chain risk. And also there isn't anything in your aircraft that's, you know, beaming back home or is an obvious cybersecurity risk.
So Green UAS is more focused on commercial enterprises, right? To be able for them to use drones that meet certain standards as well, close to the same standards as the Blue SUS. With your drone being so focused on first responders, do you see a different version of the Lemur 2 catering to commercial enterprises, or would it be the same drone, or what kind of use cases do you have in mind there?
We're very focused on public safety. So I think a lot of drone manufacturers have tried to build products that you know, service the consumer market and commercial market, industrial market and agriculture market and defense market. And they kind of try to hit everything. And I think it's just generally very hard to service all of those verticals well. So a fundamental part of our strategy has been ignore everything that isn't public safety. This is an area where we think drones can save a lot of people's lives. And we also think it's a material market opportunity. And we just want to focus on this area. So we're largely uninterested in anything that isn't public safety.
So follow-up question. Especially now with the Lemur 2, with all that new and increased capability, when you explain to a police agency, let's say, that hasn't been able to use drones in the past much, and you tell them, like, okay, this is a drone, and these are all the things you can do with this drone, like, what kind of reaction do you get from people? Because I would imagine that some of those folks might be blown away with what they can do now, or no?
I think a lot of the time when a prospective customer sees a demo of our stuff, they think back to a situation, you know, 2, 3, 5 years ago where one of their people got hurt. And they think if we had this capability, that might not have happened. We hear that a lot, that, you know, this would have provided that extra situational awareness that, you know, would have located that person with a weapon in a closet that we didn't know was there. You know, they see the value pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing. I do want to do. I don't know if you have. Do you have any more questions about the Brink too? Because I want to shift gear, but I want to make sure we can finalize this chapter first.
No, I think we're good there. I have some other questions still, but go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a bit more personal questions. I think you're a pretty young CEO for a fairly large company now that's raised, I think, 80 some million dollars in several rounds, right? What are the challenges that you found? You had this idea in your head, and now you have a company that is extremely successful. What were the challenges for you personally as a CEO, as someone who went in there with an idea, and I'm sure as an engineering background, and now you have to also manage a company? I'm actually personally interested in hearing your side of this.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. It's just two and a half years ago, I was operating from my mom's kitchen. So, you know, things have definitely changed a lot and escalated quite dramatically in that time. I think one thing that is pretty great about starting a startup is you're just sort of forced to develop competency in areas before you're allowed to graduate into subsequent areas. And I'll kind of break down what I mean by that. If I was like an incompetent project manager, product manager in the very early history of Brink, talking to customers and soliciting feedback about what I wanted to build would have to do, that probably would have killed the company. If I was an incompetent engineer after that, I wasn't able to actually build kind of what was spec'd out, that also would have killed the company. If I was incompetent at like building the first versions of this drone by hand, you know, if that couldn't work, like that would have killed the company. If I was incompetent at sales, you know, that would have killed the company. Incompetent at training or customer support, it would have killed the company. Incompetent at fundraising, it would have killed the company. So it's just like, you know, you kind of are presented with some new challenge in a very early stage company. You have to solve that challenge at least to a moderately acceptable degree before there's an opportunity to move on. And I think it just forced me to develop like a baseline of proficiency across every major department and an area that, you know, Brink has to operate in today, which I really appreciate. It's almost like an inbuilt tutorial.
Yeah, it is. So it's so you have to survive. You have to learn to survive and make it. I'm really interested in the way you said this. That's I think a great description of starting a startup and growing a startup. Do you find yourself today spending still most of your time on the engineering side of things and the product idea, product development, research and development, or more running the company, or do you rely on your employees to help you run the company on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, it's a good question. I spend most of my time on whatever the biggest problem, in the company is at that given moment. So recently that has actually been engineering. Developing Lemur 2 has sort of been like the biggest problem, more project, but still. Releasing this has been like the primary objective. So that's where a lot of my efforts have been spent. But that'll change. And sometimes there are shorter projects that get thrown in there. You know, having to recruit certain roles might become the biggest problem in the company, or supply chain issues might become the biggest problem in the company, or, you know, customer support issues might become the biggest problem in the company. And then you just sort of have to vector your effort around order to try to solve them.
So if we go back to the kitchen table, in your mom's house, where it all started. What were some of the initial breakthroughs that allowed you to take the next step and face the next challenge?
Yeah, like technical breakthroughs or breakthroughs?
Yeah, or just in general, hire or first investments, or like what were some of the key moments, let's say, in the first year that allowed you and gave you the confidence to say, okay, this might be going somewhere?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. I think there are actually some key moments that were critical to, you know, the success of the organization and Brink looking like what it does today. So, you know, first was probably when I was very young and like initially working on drone projects. And the drone projects I worked on immediately prior to Brink. I think October 1 was one of those moments for me. I think me initially reaching out to Las Vegas Metro SWAT and them answering the phone was another one of those moments. I think the first and second demo I did for Vegas Metro SWAT were important and educational. And if those had gone much worse, it probably would have also killed the company at that stage. I think our first successful live call out was an important moment when like the product developed to a point where it would, you know, it could actually help. The first time it was utilized with, you know, with an actual live mission. I think Vegas Metro. Okay. Yeah, no, go for it.
Can you tell us more about the first situation, the first time that your drone was actually put to use in that environment? Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, sure. So kind of the lead up to this was there was an attempted drive-by shooting in Las Vegas, but the attackers were unsuccessful. The person that was shot at immediately called 911, said, you know, I think I know who, well, first of all, you know, someone just tried to kill me. And second of all, I think I know who they are. Police listened. They were able to locate, you know, their address. They went out to that location. They put up a big speaker system with some normal squad cars. They started calling out to the people that they thought were inside. You know, this is Vegas Metro SWAT. You know, come with your hands up, that kind of stuff. They didn't listen. And this is like a very conventional lead up to a SWAT call out, because you have an armed and dangerous person inside of a structure, you know, resisting arrest, refusing to come out, extremely dangerous. You don't want to send patrol officers, you know, into a building like that where there might be an ambush waiting for them. So they call in the SWAT team. The SWAT team arrives. And around this time, I also got a call. So they gave me just a couple words about the situation. They said, you know, the drone's getting pretty good. Like, we think this might be the one, if you're interested. So I grab all my stuff, you know, throw it in a car, drive out as fast as I can. I arrive on scene. Almost the moment I got out of my car, I hear this huge explosion. come from where all of the, you know, all the officers are. So it's like, Jesus, what's that? They explained to me that they just placed some explosive charges on the front door to this building, and they blew out the front door in order to, and at this point they've been calling to them for several hours with some very high powered speaker systems. So they kind of had to take, you know, some additional steps. About 30 seconds after that, two people ran out of the house. So they grab the two people, they arrest them. They're talking to them afterwards. They explain to officers that there's one more person inside that isn't coming out, doesn't want to come out. So they're like, okay, get the drone. So went, grabbed the stuff, gave it to him. It was always officers piloting our equipment from the beginning due to some obvious liability challenges. So they take off. They fly up to the house. They fly through the door that has just been breached. They start exploring some of the rooms on the first story. They don't find anyone, though. They think they mostly cleared it. So they fly up to the staircase that leads up to the second story. They start flying up the stairs. They make a 180-degree turn. They scale up another flight of stairs. And then they see this person almost immediately. Already, this is very helpful because now SWAT knows that there is someone inside of this structure, and they know where they are, and they know that, you know, this person isn't holding anything, that they're not armed. So now we're seeing this person. They have a crisis negotiation team member call up the drone. They start calling out to the lady that they see, but she isn't really having it. Then she kind of gets this look in her eye and she starts beckoning the drone to follow her. It's like, man, that's kind of sketchy, but they decided they wanted to keep eyes on. So she's beckoning the drone. The pilot's following her. They get into this room. It's kind of like large walk-in closet type situation. She's inside. She's still beckoning the drone to follow her. The second the drone clears the door into this room, she goes and runs past it to try to get out, to try to lock the drone inside of the closet.
But it's like a scary movie, this.
I know, but our pilot was fast and saw this happening. So he pitched the drone really hard backwards to try to get out before it was locked in. But he crashed. He pitched so much that it was going pretty fast, crashed into the wall. We end up on our back. We're like, geez, like, I hope the drone isn't busted. But then we see like our camera moving. It's like, how's that happening? Our props are off. She grabbed it. So she grabbed the drone. She's holding both sides of it with the camera looking right at her face. We can see both of her hands on either side of our duct holding on to this thing. The crisis negotiation team is now talking to her, and she's actually responding while she's holding the drone. And the team makes the decision because, again, they know where she is. We've seen the entire structure. We know there's no one else inside. We know she's not armed. We saw her hands, and we know that both of her hands are on either side of this drone. The SWAT team made the decision to go to that exact room, second story. They knew where she was to just grab her and accomplish the arrest. And they did that safely. So that's
an amazing story. She must have. I wish I could have seen the look on her face when that drone flew up the staircase. She was like, "What?"
Yeah, people do freak out a little bit.
I would be. I mean, especially a few years ago, that would have been crazy.
Especially if they're high on drugs, which is, you know, frequently a component to these SWAT call outs. One thing that we found is pretty effective, though, is teams will use their speakers to explain what's about to happen. You know, we're going to send in a small drone to try to talk to you. And that is a good idea and a tactic we recommend.
You can communicate and talk and listen and try to convince them.
Yeah, exactly. But I'll tell you what, I mean, a suspect runs out of a house and surrenders it's the best case scenario. It's extremely good when that happens because you're not risking a gunfight, right? I mean, the alternative to our technology a lot of the time is sending in SWAT operators into an environment they don't understand and risking a gunfight. So that's, you know, that is fundamentally the value of our technology, is creating
to prevent all that
and, you know, reducing the probability of escalation.
I kind of want to go back to what we briefly touched upon earlier in this conversation. You mentioned that you guys had sent one or more drones to Turkey. There's been a massive earthquake. I think the most recent numbers were that maybe as many as 50,000 people might have died during that earthquake. Can you tell us how many drones you guys sent and what the purpose was and how they've been used?
Yeah, absolutely. So we sent a team of two people. They had three or four airframes. Primarily, their missions were looking for survivors in these buildings or identifying remains. Unfortunately, by the time we got there, a lot of buildings completely collapsed. Many buildings also only partially collapsed. But this can cause some major challenges because, you know, internal stairways might no longer, you know, be usable. Entrances to buildings might be obstructed by huge piles of rubble. These buildings also aren't always structurally stable. They frequently aren't structurally stable after an earthquake like that. And what we found, especially with all of these aftershocks, is, you know, there were additional collapsed buildings that were going down after the original wave hit, which was terrible and increases the risk for, you know, first responders to enter these things to look for people. So that's pretty much what our tools were used for, you know, flying inside, looking in specific rooms, and trying to identify folks.
And your microphone system is so sensitive that if somebody was underneath rubble and they call out for help, you might be able to pick that up.
That's correct. But even just our camera system can help quite a lot.
What's the one piece of technology that maybe doesn't exist yet or is not realistic to place on a drone that you would like to see in the next 2 to 5 years? What's the holy grail that really we don't have access to right now?
Yeah, I mean, that is a very interesting question. I mean, I think like battery technology might be a reasonable answer. Like much more energy dense batteries would be extraordinarily helpful. So that is up there. One component that we're struggling to find a little bit right now is like high optical zoom 4K block cameras with global shutters. So like that's a very, very specific answer. That would be one thing. I would say like digital video transmitters, you know, mesh networking radios that are competitive with analog in form factor and power consumption would be another one that would be extraordinarily helpful. I think HD thermal imagers, like full-blown, you know, 1080p or better thermal imagers would be really exciting. I mean, all of these things would enable some very cool future products.
What would be the Lemur 3, sounds like.
Something like that. Yeah, I mean,
we're going to... Just for...
Yeah, go for it.
So go ahead.
No, I was just saying, we're going to keep working on these things. So as technology improves across the industry, we'll implement it and hopefully drive it forward a bit ourselves.
Just for people to understand, I mean, can you give us an idea of how many of your drones are currently being used and where are they being used? Not even just in the US, but maybe also elsewhere in the world?
We built over 1,000 Lemurs. So that's across, you know, Lemur and Lemur S, almost all of which in the past 24 months. Most of our customers are in the United States, but we have others in EMEA and APAC. So I don't know the exact number of countries where our technology is operating, but it's a few dozen.
Yeah, that's crazy. 1,000. And all designed, developed, built, manufactured, assembled, shipped from the United States.
That's correct.
That's amazing. Congratulations. It's impressive.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. No, thank you. I think, I think surprisingly, we're definitely one of the largest US drone companies at this point.
Yeah. Are you expecting a lot of people who currently use the Lemur or Lemur S to be like, hey, we need the upgrade, we want a Lemur 2? Because, I mean, you're ticking a lot of their boxes on their wish list, I would imagine.
Yes, we do. And we are happy to provide some trading discounts. So, yeah, very much so.
Very cool. Well, I think we've used quite a bit of your time. We really appreciate that. I think it might be time to wrap it up, but we really want to thank you for taking the time to be there. Are you guys going to be in Texas in Burnett in next week?
Yeah, for the Texas Public Safety Summit.
Yeah, I'll see you guys over there. I'm sure you'll be doing demos of the Lemur too.
So demos start next month. So we are bringing some like kind of representative units. Demos start next month. But yeah, we'll be there. Happy to show you the stuff. Yeah, go hands-on a little bit so you can get at least a feel for kind of what we're building.
Yeah. That sounds awesome.
Maybe as a last question, if I was a police chief in any police department anywhere in this country, where do people go to find out and learn more about the Lemur 2? Like, how do I figure out what this drone can do for my department and maybe test fly it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, brinkdrones.com is a great place. BrincDrones.com. You can learn all about sort of just broadly what we built there. We talk a little bit about use cases as well. You can request a demo. So a lot of our customers want to see our technology in person and actually function, you know, at least once before they, you know, they make a purchase, which we are more than happy to provide. So, our first demos will begin, like basically early April, first week of April. So you can request a demo there, set up a time, send some, you know, folks from our team and equipment out to your location and, show you what we built in person.
Awesome. Thank you.
Cool. Yeah. Thanks for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
Well, yeah. Awesome. Thanks for joining us today.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, we'll be posting this on Tuesday. And then if anybody has questions, they can reach out on the website. And thanks for your time.
Amazing. Thank you, guys.